Marianne Rennie is sitting beside her son Mick this morning, who is going to have the marvelous experience within a short time of going to Easter Island for an archaeological digging. I envy him. Mrs. Nell Magulis, who is profiled this morning, is sitting with her family, her son Michael, daughter-in-law Lori, and grandson Nick, and the four of them will be standing together out in Fellowship Hall. Michael and Lori and Nick are already a part of this place. It's a special joy to welcome Nell. As most of you know, I recently urged members and visitors to leave a note if they wanted me to respond to some specific question from the pulpit. I'm not as sure this morning as I have been that that was a wise thing for me to do. The response has so far exceeded my expectations that I have decided this morning, when I have a little less time than usual, to make brief responses to four questions, any one of which might reasonably provoke a full sermon of its own. The questions will perhaps surprise you a little as they surprised me. Someone wonders, first of all, how I vote. In political elections, a question which I assume seeks to make some connection between my sermons and my political affiliation. Well, you're going to be disappointed. The answer requires only one sentence. I vote for the candidate who seems most likely to implement the Christian values I believe in. At different times, that candidate may be running as a Republican, as a Democrat, or as an independent. I have never plumped for any candidate by name from the pulpit because that does not strike me as my mission. My job is to clarify Christian values as lucidly as I can. And your responsibility, if you share those values, is to vote for the person most likely to govern by them. Does that strike you as sufficiently evasive? Question number two, when is divorce right? Since the question came to me as a minister, I assume the person asking it respects a response based on Christian principles. Listen carefully. In the ideal community Jesus hoped to establish, no marriage would end in divorce. So he did not speak of exceptions. But the early church recognized quickly that the ideal cannot always be realized, that there might have to be exceptions. So the Apostle Paul adds one in his letter to the church at Corinth, and Matthew adds another one in his version of the Sermon on the Mount. Neither Paul nor Matthew have anything to say about the harm that may be done to children in a hopeless marriage. Thoughtless divorce can be devastating to children, but I have seen marriages so bad that children were far better off when they ended. People join in marriage sometimes who are so ill-suited and so unwilling to make changes that home life is in constant turmoil, joyless, undisciplined, filled with constant strife and physical abuse of one kind or another. And in such cases, I have been convinced that ending the marriage was the best hope. both for the sake of one or two partners whose lives are lacerated daily, and for the sake of children who are being crippled for life by growing up in such an atmosphere. But the reason for divorce is the key. People of faith have to be honest. I see divorces that are purely selfish, with no regard at all for the partner in marriage and no regard for the consequences to the children. Those divorces are wrong and tragic. But I see others which appear to be the most compassionate solution to intractable problems, an assumption which I think is validated when husband and wife and children are all obviously far better off after the marriage comes to an end. Keep in mind, please, that Jesus put individuals ahead of institutions. People are not made for the Sabbath, he said. The Sabbath exists for their sake. Institutions exist for people. And our Lord loved people. I am aware, of course, that the Christian world itself is divided on this painful matter, and that your response to this question might be different from mine. Question number three takes us back 2 or 3 years to an issue I mentioned briefly from the pulpit. Once again, some politicians are considering an amendment to the Constitution that would prohibit flag burning as an act of political protest. So, how do you feel about this as a Christian minister? Somebody wondered. In one of those blessed moments of serendipity, on the very day I got that note, I also read editor James Wall's essay in the Christian Century, which summed up my own feelings so well, I'd like to quote 2 or 3 paragraphs of it. The whole issue reminds me, Wall said, of a story about a meeting of a Methodist conference at which an irate bishop demanded to know why Brother Jones was not present for the opening session. A colleague of Jones responded, "Well, Bishop, in the first place, he's dead." The flag-burning issue is pretty much dead. Only 3 incidents of flag-burning have been reported since 1933. The people dishonoring the flag most these days, Mr. Wall says, are the politicians who want to wrap themselves up in it. Nevertheless, he goes on, because another national campaign season has begun, the Senate is prepared to vote on a constitutional amendment to ban flag burning. A version has already been adopted by the House of Representatives. Unless the Senate decides to exercise some wise leadership, the amendment will soon be on its way to the states for ratification. We do not need a constitutional amendment to protect the flag. The amendment process should be restricted to those rare occasions when it is necessary to correct major flaws in the original constitution of government. For example, to protect the civil rights of minorities, to ensure voting rights for women, or clarify the transfer of power in the event of a president's death or illness. Wall goes on to point out that one major theological error in this whole discussion is the use of the term desecration. To desecrate is to attack that which is sacred in itself, a term which should not be applied to the symbol of a secular state. A better way to describe offensive treatment of the flag would be to speak of dishonoring or disfiguring a national symbol. I like that distinction because I get the shakes whenever it seems to me that someone would like to see America become a theocracy. I believe profoundly in the wisdom of a separation of church and state. I love the land I live in, and I feel deep respect for the flag which symbolizes it. I am offended to see it burnt. But who is burning flags? There were never many burnt. Even when that had a passing popularity, and most of us have never personally witnessed that particular exhibition of bad taste. The flag-burning flap really is a non-issue, except for politicians who hope to win votes by posing as more patriotic than an opponent. The best thing to do about an occasional flag-burning is to do what that wise university vice president, Dr. James Rattigan, a member of this church, did years ago when the streaking fad came to the Wichita State campus. I remember walking out of my office one day to join a crowd lured by the rumor that several streakers would make an appearance. I thought I should see this in order to report to my congregation. Well, sure enough, after anticipation had built for a while, here they came, a couple of boys, as naked as the day they were born, looking strangely innocent, after all, as if they were two small children who had escaped from their bath, and running very, very fast because they were sane, after all, and no sane person wants to walk slowly past the crowd in his birthday suit. What Dr. Rattigan did basically was to stay calm in his unique manner and ignore the whole silly business as much as possible in the conviction that if it generated no explosions from administrators, it would very likely die a sudden death, which is exactly what happened. Flag burning, in my opinion, should be greeted not by an amendment, but by ridicule. And finally, this unexpected request from someone who is probably making a statement rather than asking a question. Jesus mentioned taxes, politics, and business in his teaching. What do you think he would say today about the tobacco industry? Ouch. Even if we didn't know already how touchy this issue is, that single angry letter from a beleaguered smoker in last Friday's newspaper would be enough. I hope some of you read it. I guess I can be grateful for two things. First, that this note asks only about the industry and not about dear friends of mine who smoke. And second, that I don't have to respond to this question from a pulpit in Kentucky. My first thoughts as I tried to frame a brief answer were about my father. Dead long before the first health warnings appeared on packs of cigarettes, he smoked with such happy abandon that during the Depression years, he bought one of those little roll-your-own machines and brought it home with sacks of tobacco and packages of cigarette papers. the kind of little machine guaranteed to intrigue a small child. I hated the very smell of smoke, but I loved my father so much that I sat for hours at the dining room table making piles of cigarettes for him to smoke. Proud and happy when they were tight and firm at both ends. As it turned out, I was helping him to an early death with heart and lung disease. But neither of us knew anything at all about that risk. My response to the question I have been asked is obviously colored by my having sat at his hospital bed and at the bed of dozens and dozens of others in my lifetime of ministry who died for the same reason he did. Some of you may decide that this diminishes the usefulness of my reply, but I feel obligated to make one. I believe absolutely that smoking is addictive, and that the most hypocritical scene I have ever witnessed was that group of 9 blue suits, executives of the nation's 7 largest tobacco companies, with their right hands raised to swear to tell the truth, making statements like this one from the president of Philip Morris: "I really don't accept that smoking is addictive." It's one thing to say that people should have a right to smoke if they wish to. It's quite another thing to look into a camera with a straight face and under oath and say that smoking is not addictive. This man, after all, had every chance in the world to know better. A document from his own company, entered into the congressional record, shows that they were told in 1969, over 25 years ago, that the craving for tobacco becomes so powerful that on the smoker's priority list, cigarettes will sometimes even preempt food in times of scarcity. That report went on to say that the ultimate explanation for the perpetuated cigarette habit resides in the pharmacological effect of smoke upon the body of the smoker. He knew that. But he said under oath that cigarettes are not addictive. I think you know, smokers and non-smokers alike, what the man who threw heartless profiteers out of the temple courtyard would say to a group of powerful men who, for profit's sake, would say with a straight face what everybody knows is a blatant lie. I think you also know that the man who loved children and blessed them would call for an immediate end to the reprehensible advertising designed to get them addicted early. It is one thing for a grown-up to decide to run the risks involved in habitual smoking. It's something else when children, vulnerable to peer pressure and some of the most seductive advertising ever dreamed up, are overcome by what the present occupant of the White House calls the deadly temptation of tobacco. I am suddenly ashamed of myself for not being in the streets protesting this crime against children and wondering what the founder of this church would say to me for not doing more. Now, with a measure of temporary relief, having dealt with those 4 questions, I invite you to turn from the struggle with these difficult issues to an exercise of heart and imagination no less essential than critical intelligence in the Christian life. You are invited now to join the millions of people around the world this morning who are celebrating worldwide Communion Sunday. We have no tests, For those who wish to join us in this ritual, except to say to you that imagination is crucial because we are inviting you to feel for these next blessed moments what an amazing thing it is to be together, to be loved, and to be capable of love.